Listen to WGN Radio's newest podcast, Behind the Badge, Illinois, hosted by David Hochberg. Behind the Badge, Illinois views current events through the eyes of Illinois law enforcement leaders. Tune in. Visit WGNradio.com/behindthebadge.
In a tower by the river, there lived a man.
Castle.
There was a man who took a stand. With pen and paper in his hand, defeating foes in every ward with a pen more mighty than the sword. No escape from his ink lasso in a tower by the river, Castle.
Here's how you get him. He pulls a knife, you pull a gun. He sends one of yours to the hospital, you send one of his to the morgue. That's the Chicago way.
Yes, Mr. and Mrs. America, this is John Cass, your mild-mannered columnist for the Chicago Tribune. And, my friend, his name is not Sancho Panza, it is Jeff Carlin, WGN AM radio producer for the Rokan and Anna show. And every day I come to work at the Chicago Tribune, I read the paper and read other papers. I look at the news just like you do because you're listening to this, so you must be interested in the news. And I noticed over the past, I don't know, all my life that the news, radio, TV, print is slanted liberal. And every time I mention it, I get the, oh, God. Oh, and it's just here. I also hear it on the street and, you know, where else do you hear it? On Twitter and Facebook. Here's the deal with that. It is liberal. It does slant left. And we're going to be talking to Tom Bevan of Real Clear Politics, a guy who should know. But first, we're going to talk to Christian McQuarrie, the spiritual sister of the Chicago Way podcast, also the excellent columnist and editorial board member of the Chicago Tribune. I hear she's got something to talk about in terms of hot dogs and education. Christian McQuarrie.
Hi.
Hey, Jeff. Christian's here.
Welcome, welcome,
well,
Kristen.
Well, thanks. Appreciate the warm welcome.
Last I talked to Kristen was through third-party Twitter. She put out something about National Wine Day, and it's good to have a glass of wine. And I thought, okay, so I asked her what wine goes with Fat Johnny's hot dogs. She didn't. Did you say?
I did. I said a chilled white Pinot Blanc with a side of Pepsin.
That's right.
I found out later it was not actually National Wine. You know how there's a day of
You're
every
right.
day is something. It's actually in another week, so I'll get to celebrate again.
Oh, but man.
I really find it's unpatriotic to ignore national holidays. So when it's National Wine Day, you have to have a glass of wine.
I'd say we need a bottle.
Yeah,
right.
Absolutely,
or two with a bowl of ripe Bosque pears and some.
Hungry. Every podcast you make
cheddar?
Me hungry.
They don't call me the second Fat Johnny for nothing.
Well, okay? What did you get at Fat Johnny's?
Well, first of all, I said, "Are you the Fat Johnny?" And I said, "I'm Fat Johnny." And he goes, "No, you're not. You're not the Fat Johnny." But I had probably the best cheese dog I've ever had.
Really?
In my life. I always order the classic dog.
Yes, I do too.
And then I noticed this. I could put stuff on Trump, like Flynn. Counterintuitive. John Cass says, Donald Trump, you're acting like a panicking baby. And Flynn, you might have committed treason. Okay?
Yes.
And then put that on Facebook.
Yes.
On the two Facebook pages. And then also put, hey, I went to Fat Johnny's the other day. Which one gets more Facebook attention?
Of course. I mean.
And then I said, Janssen's. Was one in a column. Janssen's was good.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't mention Gene and Jude's because I wanted to see how many people would mention it. And everyone's on me for Janssen's from the South Side. They're saying, what about Fat Tommy's?
Yeah.
Huh?
So Fat Tommy's is, I think their main spot is on 111th Street in Mount Greenwood.
Yeah, right.
But they also have these little hot dog carts, so you can catch them sometimes along Western Avenue or at Kennedy Park where my kids are playing ball. You know, they're delicious, too. I got to tell you, though, the very best hot dog is the kind you buy at a real butcher shop.
You are so right.
I mean,
what kind is it? Don't you know?
They're just all beef hot dogs,
right? What are they?
I don't know.
I'll tell you.
Okay.
As a former butcher.
What?
Who knows when meat is turning
bad.
Oh, no.
Oh, wait. You're going to tell me actually what's in it?
No.
Okay.
Don't worry about that. I'm going to tell you where the best hot dog, if you're going to make them at home.
Yes.
First of all, go to the store, get the neon green piccalilli or relish, whatever you call it, right?
Yes.
You also get the yellow mustard.
Yes.
Chopped onions, celery salt. Okay?
Yes.
You can do the and
poppy seed
sport peppers.
Okay.
Rosin, poppy seed buns. Have to have it. Now, you're going to make hot dogs at home, which if you have a bunch of kids over, you could drop like $30 if you don't go to Fat Johnny's, which is $2.50 a hot dog.
Yes.
But you could drop a lot of money going out, or you can make them at home, and it's real easy, and it's easier for them, right?
Yes.
So here's what you do. Go to the butcher. Get a Daisy brand hot dog.
Really?
They're called Daisy brands.
Okay.
And they're two kinds, skin on, skin off. Anybody who gets skin off, a skinless hot dog, is a communist.
I was going to say, is this like a circumcised hot dog? Excuse me.
Whoa, like, now I'm never going to eat a hot dog again. You're like, well, you just pulled that thing. What was the guy with the Heineken bottle guy?
Oh, jeez.
Oh, God.
You broke that down, John. You were overreacting to that.
Heineken thing?
Yeah, you and I talked about
that.
Now
she did that.
Yeah, That was.
I'm never drinking Heineken again.
Well, it's probably for the best.
Okay, right. So I want the uncircumcised hot dog.
Oh, go shut up!
Right back to it.
What's it called
again?
You're
so bad. Can't we be a dignified journalist today? Yeah, it's called Daisy Brand.
Okay.
They're made at the Crawford Sausage Company. I think it's like 22nd or Cermak and Pulaski. We used to sell these from along with Tom Tom Tamales at our grocery store.
Delicious.
Yeah.
My grandmother, when she got up in age, there were only two things in life that she had to have was her daily dry gin martini and a Tom Tom Tamale. Like, and my dad, every time we go to visit, we stop.
Outsider, your grandma?
No, Norridge. So I grew up in Norridge.
Great.
So you can import Tom Tom Tamales up to Norridge? It's kind of like
the South
Side, though.
We had to run.
Norridge
them,
is like a South Side thing. Isn't it?
It's kind of bungalow belty.
Bungalow belty,
kind of little.
It's not so much anymore.
Touch of Chinatown.
Yeah.
Without the, you know, Asian people, but I mean the others.
Right.
Right. There's a little thing there.
Okay, so do you grill the hot dog then, or do you boil it?
No, I don't boil. You don't boil a hot dog. Get Daisy brand hot dog skin on. They're coming a little chain, like you break. You know, they're linked together. That's why they're called links. You boil water, a saucepan with water. As soon as it comes to a boil, turn off the boil. Turn off the heat. Then put the hot dogs in. Cover it with. You can cover it or not, but I cover it. Wait 5 minutes, put them in, and then eat them.
Wow! So they just gradually cook them slowly so that they don't boil out all
They're
the flavor
the best,
and the juices.
The best hot dog, if you're going to make one at home.
And John, do you boil them in like a brine or is it just straight water? Because I know some people will brine water.
No. Brine water, if the bubbles are going and you drop a hot dog in it, I think it makes it tougher.
You're probably right. I'm just curious because I've seen some people using brine.
Like bratwurst baths.
Yeah.
I've never heard of that, but yeah, cool.
Yeah, my friend used to do her bratwurst all the time in beer and onions. I don't know that it really infused much flavor into the bratwurst, but hungry
You got to brown it. So. Why don't you? So you've seen these hot dogs, right? You've the butcher shop hot dog.
Yes,
right?
And the reason I know about them. So my sister is a vegetarian. Both of them actually. The only time that she will venture off the farm or to the farm, whatever, is to eat these hot dogs. And she kept talking about how delicious they were. I mean, this is someone who doesn't eat. You know, she won't eat like a really organic, lovely piece of chicken or something. But she'll eat a hot dog, which is. The ground up parts of
some of them are beef, all beef, and I got a friend Mike Burns, podiatrist of the Stars on the Southwest Side, and he like will only eat David Berg hot dog, you know, because Abraham Lincoln had one. He said,
"Well, I buy them, but I will not waste them on my children because they won't finish it, they won't appreciate
it. Cut them in half.
I don't even know if they would like it. I'll try.
It sort of tastes like a hot dog. I mean, it doesn't taste like. There was a place, though, Franken Dogs. You ever hear of that on Clyburn?
No.
It was like a gourmet hot dog, but it wasn't even a hot dog. These were line cooks. It looked like a hot dog stand. Line cooks from True and Blackbird.
No.
Yes.
What?
And they were making, they'd make like, they'd make their own sausage and brats by hand, and then they would put all their little gourmet touch with real truffle fries, not like fake.
So it was delicious.
Oil, fake truffle oil fries, which suck. Yeah, they're delicious.
I'm getting some homemade sausage for Memorial Day weekend by a couple of my friends who are Italian, and they ran a little sausage shop in Homewood called Hungry Hill.
Okay.
The sausage shop is no longer there, but I will bring you some. It is fantastic, and it's handmade. I've watched them make it. It's, you know, just pork shoulder and seasoning and casing, all handmade. Really delicious.
What do they make? The sweet and the hot Italian sausage?
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Okay, here's one.
Okay.
Another to make Kristen hungry. Take hot or sweet Italian sausage, crumble it, brown it. Okay?
Okay.
Drain off the oil, right? Throw in rapini.
I have no idea what that is.
It's a vegetable.
It looks green.
Sounded like
rapini, motor oil.
Right?
Okay.
It's like kind of like broccoli. It's
okay.
A little bitter. So the sausage, the sweet sausage is sweet. And the bitter.
Mm.
You mix that together on little orecchiette or those little ear pastas.
Yes.
And make a little pan sauce.
Oh, that sounds delicious.
That's all you need. A little cheese. Thank you.
And if you can't find rapini, arugula works well, too. It's
a leafy.
Yeah. It's a thick stem, but instead of having like the brussely parts of Brussels sprouts or broccoli, rather, it's like leaves.
There, okay.
Like thicker leaves. But
all right.
It's a bitter and almost salty, but yeah.
All right, so we're talking hot dogs. I didn't get to talk to you about crime or Rahm Emanuel throwing Forrest Claypool, his good buddy, under the bus.
Yeah, I've been doing a lot of digging on that story.
Well, okay, here's my take on it. Rahm knew what was going to happen. Now, give us the overview, though.
The Chicago Teachers Union sometime soon will release the results of this no confidence vote that they took among their teachers in Forrest Claypool, who is the CEO. There was a lot of speculation. There's been some tension between Rahm Emanuel and Forrest Claypool. And so there is some belief that Rahm is somehow behind this no confidence vote. I don't know if I believe that because CTU is so, to me, just a radicalized union. They go after Rahm just as much as they do
how much
Forrest
does
Claypool.
The city, how much is the city or the schools in the red?
Oh, I mean,
what? They had we were 200 million. Now we're five. What is the number?
Seven, right? That's the last I heard.
I'm not even sure what the operating deficit is. I know they have to make like a really big pension payment in June. But even once they make those payments, we continue to slide down into oblivion because the money is just never going to make up for the debt and the interest that we owe. They've gone so long. And so that's why this no confidence vote in Forrest Claypool is just theatrical Karen Lewis. Forrest Claypool has been on the job less than 2 years. He was appointed in July of 2015. He is not responsible for 20 years of mismanagement at CPS.
No, Rich Daley is.
Rich Daley appointed all the board members, and so has Rahm Emanuel over the past 6 years. They appoint the CPS board who continue to borrow. They waited too long to close schools. They have a huge real estate footprint in the city where we're leasing buildings for ridiculous amounts of money. Kids are leaving. You know, they've ignored this whole enrollment problem. Money follows the kids now. So part of the reason CPS is strained is because families are leaving and they've ignored that problem. So to me, you know, whatever.
That's why Daley built all these schools, because kids were leaving.
Or
did he just want to take care of the contractors and the guy, the electricians that I know from Tinsley Park and Orland Park, all those.
I mean, that was, you know, part of it.
There, IBW boys.
There was a push under Daley to try to keep middle-class white families from fleeing the city. And in order to do that, they created more of a magnet school program, a selective enrollment school. They made the neighborhood schools more attractive. That's, of course, where, you know, most of the higher-ups in CTU send their kids. You know, Jesse Sharkey's kids, the vice president of CTU, his kids don't go to his actual neighborhood school. They go to a magnet school and a selective enrollment school within CPS.
Right. It's called the two-tier political cynical
right.
education.
I actually had my daughter tested for a selective. I would have been open to public schools, but it's impossible to really get your kids in some of these desirable slots.
Unless you know somebody. See, that's the whole lie about it. I know aldermen who've done it. We've done stories about it. I know people who do it, who've called, how do I get my kid in? Journalists can't do it because, clearly it's wrong to do.
My married name is different from my name that I use at work. Okay. So I was extra careful to make sure that this was right. just regular old me. And so, of course, regular old me and my kid didn't get in a selective.
So then
school.
That's where a lot of people decide I'm going. If I can't get my kids into these top schools, I go to Catholic schools or I'm gone.
Or I move, right. So CPS has enrollment has continued to plummet. That's not an exaggeration. So the funding is dropping. And the state, run by Democrats solely for 12 years, failed to fix a broken school funding formula that punishes poor kids. They had 12 years to do it. They're supposedly the middle class, mm-hmm. we're working. No, they have perpetuated a system where if you live in a rich area, you get a good school. And if you live in a poor zip code, you get
okay,
a
hold on
bad
there,
school.
Though.
Yeah.
What a rich area means you're paying a lot in property taxes.
You are.
And I don't think if you say Brookfield is rich, I don't think
no,
so.
No.
But people do. One of the reasons why I moved out of the city, besides crime, when I told you the guy's story about the automatic weapon fire.
Right.
The other one was schools, because we thought we were going to have kids right away. And it took, 8-10 years before we had them. But one of the Daily guys said, don't worry, no matter what you write about rich, your kids are still going to get into the magnet schools. And I thought, okay, that means I really got to go.
Oof.
Right? I have to go. Mm-hmm. I can't be part of this. That's how they suck you in. So people who go to the suburbs pay a lot of property taxes. They are risk. Why do they do that? Because they know I'm going to have to pay property taxes. Sometimes $10,000, $15,000, $20,000. They're not rich. And then they're doing that because their schools are smaller districts. If the test scores go down one percentage point, the whole community goes crazy, right? Like, how did you let this happen? And I don't see that in the large public schools. So who's going to? The Democrats didn't do anything for when they had the super majorities and Democratic governors. They did nothing except expand our Medicaid rolls so they could get more voters.
Well, part of the reason
who's going to pay now? The suburbs?
No, I reject that argument. When school funding changes were first debated and when this became, when bills were actually emerging on the floor, it wasn't so much to steal money from the suburbs. It was to shift our focus, our reliance on property taxes to the income tax. The income tax, the state is supposed to be the primary funder of schools. That's in the Constitution. Nobody fights for that clause in the Constitution because we're too busy protecting
right.
our pensions. But a shift to the income tax where the state is picking up 50% or more of your local funding, instead of, because the state is now dropped to about 26%, the burden falls on the property tax. And what happens is, if you are in a Nutria or a district like that, you're getting less state funding and you are totally reliant on your property taxes. But if you are in Ford Heights or Park Forest or Dalton or Harvey, you don't even have the property wealth to make up for it. So your schools are just—they are starving. It's just wrong. So that's my beef: is that it never shifted.
What's the solution? I got to go to Indiana because my kids are out of school now. So where do I have to live? Like Wisconsin and commute in? I mean, I don't want to end
the
up.
The tollways are going to pay for education. Did I miss
the lottery?
Oh, lottery!
The lottery
bad.
Was supposed to. Be.
Jim Thompson, yeah, baby. I mean,
it's never enough money, and my issue sometimes with some of these larger I wrote about Hinsdale, and they had a referendum that went down in flames, and I was I'll have to see it. But you,
but people were choosing.
You know, you're also choosing to live in an area where you want your school district to spend $23,000 per kid. Personally, I don't really think New Trier needs to spend $23,000 per kid.
Who's going
to
tell them? No, you don't have the right. No one has the right to tell me. Not that I'm in New Trier. Because I wouldn't, because I wouldn't want my kids to be propagandized into little liberal apparatchiks, you know, like they do. But that's their right. That's their
absolutely. So don't complain about your high property taxes then, because you are choosing a, you're electing your school board, you're passing referendums to build new buildings. So pay your $23,000 per student fees, pay your $20,000 property tax bill, or in some cases $30,000 property tax bill, and keep your mouth shut then. Or fight for a shift from the property tax to the income tax so that the state is the primary funder of schools as it's supposed to be. And so for that argument, I'm thinking of the people in Fort Heights who have no, who in terms of their household income, they are paying way more to sustain their public schools and getting really bad, shabby results than the people who are paying higher property taxes and at least getting good results.
I agree that that's an issue. Here's another issue. Mm-hmm. If you change the tax formula and make it easier on Mr. and Mrs. Cass so we don't have to pay higher property taxes. Mm-hmm. The problem is that people, the smaller communities that do this, the reason why I didn't have a car for 10 years, why I didn't have a car, why I had holes in my shoes while I was working at the Trip, because I was trying to, so we could stay in that house so the boys could go to school there. I mean, you know this. People think, oh, you're reporters, you make a lot of money. That's not necessarily the case.
Yeah.
But I sacrificed all that for them. Now, if you change the funding formula, you're also changing something else, real estate values. No? How's that going to play?
I mean, I don't think shifting the money from the property tax to the income tax is going to do something to make the schools less desirable. It's just going to, the funding source is just going to come from a different area that doesn't punish people based on their zip code. The state has more of a responsibility to more fairly distribute the money. And right now, because it's on property taxes and because schools are zoned in little districts, if you live in a district with no property wealth, you're screwed. You are absolutely screwed. So I don't think the shift that I'm talking about from one tax to another tax is going to impact property. And I think that's what you mean. Like, you don't want the schools to start going downhill because then people won't want to move to your area. Right. I just don't see that happening. And I think some of these districts cry wolf about, you know, oh my gosh, we couldn't possibly cut this amount of money and we won't be able to attract good teachers, and yet they have resumes, you know, this high.
Getting a teacher's job in some of these districts is like getting a painter's job at City Hall. I know, because my wife is a teacher and she hasn't gotten it. You know what I mean?
So
it's like you have to
are
be
they
connected.
Desire- oh,
there's so a there's- connected thing, mm-hmm. right? So, Kristen, next time I see you, I know you have to go because you're decked out in your, you know,
John
bar,
asked you about
bar association.
I was going to a funeral.
No, she's wearing black.
I didn't
she
know what to
very,
ask when I saw you walking.
Very professional.
All black. Very professional.
You know, all black, very professional. Yep. And with the ponytail. And she's going to sit there and do like a bar association meeting, talk about important things, not hot dogs.
Right.
But the next time you come in, I'd like to hear about the Daisy Brand hot dog. I might bring some Daisy Brands.
I'll bring you my the Hungry Hill sausage.
All right, we'll good.
Have a little
sausage exchange.
It's called pasta. What I gave you the recipe, it's real easy. It's called pasta barese.
Okay.
I love it. Thanks.
I love when he speaks. I love when he speaks with an accent.
It's fun.
Yes. With us now is Tom Bevan, the co-founder and publisher of Real Clear Politics, my favorite website next to, of course, the Chicago Tribune. And Tom had a great column earlier last week about James Clapper, being used as a cudgel against Trump. What is going on with that, Tom Bevin? Why do people use Clapper as a cudgel against Trump? Because they just want to?
Well, I mean, it was less about that, John. I mean, the administration has been citing James Clapper because he has said on the record on a number of different occasions that there's no evidence of collusion. My beef with James Clapper is that he went on these Sunday shows and he was testifying before Congress just, you know, the other week, and he was on the Sunday shows and he was on CNN in particular and said that there was a real, this was an assault against our institutions, and that, an eroding of our institutions, an assault on democracy, et cetera, et cetera. And A, he's wrong on the merits of that, which I point out in the piece, which is that, you know, he was talking about our checks and balances. Well, the FBI director is part of the Justice Department. That's part of the executive. The president has the ability to fire the FBI director at any time for any reason. And in fact, we've had FBI directors fired in the past for good reasons and not so good reasons. And it's never been referred to as some sort of crisis of democracy until today. But more importantly, I point out in the piece, and this is my big beef with James Clapper, is that this is a guy, what really undermines democracy and erodes it and assaults it is having senior members of the government lie under oath to members of Congress, which is what James Clapper did regarding the NSA surveillance thing. And so it just kind of rubbed me the wrong way, and I wanted to kick him in the shins a little bit about, you know, the fact that this guy lied under oath to Congress, denied he lied under oath, subsequently changed his story, apologized to Congress, and nothing ever happened to him. He was on as the director of national intelligence through the end of Obama's term, and he's still, again, seen as an authority on these matters, and he's quoted, he testifies before Congress, he's on the Sunday shows, and he is, not quite the beacon of hope and light that everyone treats him to be, because, you know, he has, I think, damaged his own reputation by his past actions.
And that's where I get to the media bias, and here's why. Or let's put it this way, maybe intellectual dishonesty, which is a way of covering or accompanying bias. If James Clapper were sitting here right now with you and me, and he said the same things, I guarantee you that either John Cass or Tom Bevin would say, very, very good, Mr. Clapper, but didn't you lie before Congress on surveillance of the American people? We would have said that. The fact that he can show up on CNN or wherever any of these shows, and they take his testimony and use it as a cudgel against the Trump administration without mentioning the facts that you outlined in your column suggest to me an intellectual dishonesty that is about bias. Yes or no?
Well, yeah, I think so. I mean, I do. I mean, it reminds me of the Sandy Berger thing, right? Got
when he stole
documents
the stuff?
Down his pants, right? Yeah. Right. I mean, this is the kind of thing that would cause a huge uproar, would end the career of anyone. And Sandy Berger was still. Seen as an authority, and he wrote columns and he was on Sunday shows and whatnot. I mean, I think there is, in that sense, a bit of a double standard because, you know, there have been plenty of folks, and Victor Davis Hanson actually had a great piece on this also this week about the fact that we don't have enough accountability among members of the government sort of ruling class. You look at Lois Lerner, you look at Susan Rice. I mean, they've gone on. I mean, Susan Rice in particular has gone on television and lied to the American people repeatedly and said things that were demonstrably untrue. And yet she stayed in her position. She never suffered any consequences for that. Lois Lerner, you know, was allowed to, abuse her position and never suffered any consequences for that. And that is one of the things that I think is. It's disheartening, but it also that kind of stuff damages democracy. When you talk about why the public does not trust Congress, does not trust institutions of government, they feel like, there's this disconnect between what's going on in their lives and how people in Washington are conducting themselves. That's part of it. And we saw that on display again with Clapper just this past week.
We're talking with Tom Bevin, co-founder and publisher of Real Clear Politics, who also is a radio personality of his own on WLS and has a Twitter feed or Twitter handle at Tom Bevin RCP. And if you look at that Twitter feed or whatever it is, handle or whatever, a few days ago, you'd have seen him tweet this. Harvard study, media coverage of Trump's first 100 days has been 80% negative. CNN, NBC, and CBS even higher, 90%. When I write in my column that the media is biased against Trump, I'm invariably met with eye-rolling, kind of like Anderson Cooper eye-rolling, from some of my editors who are friends. You know, they're friends, and they're like, oh, God, there he goes again. And here we have Harvard University laying this out. What does that tell us?
I think it confirms what most people understand. And look, the response would be, well, Trump has been deserving of this bad coverage because he's conducted himself inappropriately, or these are self-inflicted wounds, and the press is just doing nothing other than just, you know, covering him and his actions. But obviously, I think that's a little bit disingenuous. I mean, I think Trump has been treated unfairly by the press in his first 100 days. Everything he does is seen as a five-alarm fire. I mean, this story about what took place in the Oval Office, the Washington Post story that he had disclosed classified information to the Russians in this meeting. First of all, the three people who were in the room, the principals who were in the room, Rex Tillerson, Dina Powell, and H.R. McMaster, all said it didn't happen and that the conversation was appropriate and there was nothing out of the ordinary, versus these anonymous sources that, you know, former and current and former government officials. That kind of stuff happens all the time. If you talk to people who've been in the State Department and who have worked in the White House, and they say, you know, this is not unusual. And in fact, it was pretty easy to dig up the fact that Obama did it a couple of times during his term on various different issues. And it was never seen as this egregious violation and stemming from his inexperience or any of these other things, his recklessness. So just using that as one example, the tone and the tenor of the way Trump has been covered, I think, has been really sort of beyond the pale in terms of blowing everything out of proportion. I think most people understand that. Now, has he had some self-inflicted wounds along the way? Sure. Does he operate in sort of the traditional manner of a president? Does he speak in all the right ways? No. And that causes him some grief. But I think the study by Harvard shows that not only has Trump been, you know, is it really true? Like CNN, for example, 93% of their coverage has been negative about Trump. You know, that speaks to a level of unfairness that that I think most people recognize. And if you go to their front page of CNN.com, you'll see it every day. I do. I go there every day and I see story after story after story framed in the worst possible light for Trump and his administration and members of his cabinet, et cetera. And the other thing that media study pointed out, John, is that, you know, Bill Clinton got 60-40 negative coverage. George Bush got 60-40 negative coverage for their first 100 days. Trump's getting 80-20 negative coverage. Guess what Barack Obama got? 60-40 positive coverage. I mean, a significant shift, a significant difference, significant change. And you can't sit here and tell me that Barack Obama somehow conducted himself in a manner that was so much better than, I mean, he had his foibles and stumbles and negative news stories about his, you know, during his first 100 days too. Yet, you know, Obama got 60% positive coverage. And I think that is reflective of the fact that the media does root from the press box. I mean, they do cheer for certain personalities and they do cheer against others. And I think, look, I think folks in the media can sit here and argue all they want that they're objective and all that. But I think the truth and this Harvard study speaks to the opposite, which is there is a bias in the media. And I think everybody kind of understands that.
But the people that voted for Trump aren't part of that culture. The people that voted for Trump aren't part of the culture that looks at its phone, right, 24/7 to see if Real Clear Politics has your column, or what did Tom Bevin tweet, or what did Jeff Carlin or John Cass tweet, or they're not involved in that bubble. So they're on the outside of it. These are working class people who said they voted for Trump because they wanted him to go and kick Washington in the crotch. And now what I see is the media generally, the establishment media, working, as I think you and I have talked about for years, as almost like clerks or protectors of this hive, the protectors of the establishment. And here comes Trump, the anti-establishment, whether he is or not, he's cast that way, the personality that's sort of like what? He's like some sort of cell outside the body that is being kicked, you know, that is the host is trying to expel him as if he was some sort of virus. And you can see that reflected in the coverage. But in the larger picture, what does that do? What does that say to the American people who aren't part of it?
Well, I think we have seen, I mean, there's no question, everything you said is true. I mean, you have this group of folks now who, and there was this CBS went and interviewed some of them, and you see these stories from time to time. I mean, they just literally do not trust anything that the media says anymore. They will not accept it. I mean, even if it is true, they'll say, you know, this is just the media out to get Trump. Prior to President Obama, I think there was this general understanding that, I think people thought, or conservatives, Republicans, working class folks, whatever, they thought, okay, there's a bias in the media, you know, mostly lean to Democrats, et cetera, et cetera. But that was sort of the equilibrium. Those were the sort of the rules of the game, and it was everybody understood. But because of the way that the press covered Obama, and which I think they lost so much credibility during the Obama years because they did not take any of these things seriously. The IRS scandal, Fast and Furious. I mean, you can go down the list of all these things and of where they sort of turned the other cheek and did not give him the same sort of coverage. And then they turn around with Trump and they're giving him this sort of third degree on everything to just make the contrast all that much more. You do have a situation now where there's a certain section of the public, whether it's 30% or 35% or 40% or all 46% that voted for Trump in November, who just literally do not trust anything that the media says anymore. They've just completely tuned them out, written them off, and there's this disconnect. And it's bad for the country. It's bad for – certainly bad for journalism, but more broadly –
Why is it bad for the country, Tom?
Because I think we do need to be able to have a set of unifying facts and be able to sort of be unified around news and information, you know, because right now we have people living in two separate universes. I mean, you look at a single story and progressives can take from that an entirely different result and conclusion, and then the other half of the country can. They can look at a story and one set of folks will see the end of the republic, and the other folks will see, you know, nothing wrong there, nothing to do, because it's just the media sort of out to get Trump. And the reality is stories are never that black and white. You know this, John. I mean, there's nuance and there are shades of gray, and the press needs to, you know, in a perfect world, the press is sort of, you know, an arbiter and is able to explain those news stories to people in a way that resonates with both sides. And right now we have neither. And so I think it's bad, certainly bad for journalism. And I just think it's a bad situation for the country, where we are, and beyond media, we've just divided along tribal lines over the last, 15 to 20 years, to the point where it's hard for folks to even, talk to each other anymore. If you have different opinions about politics, it is almost, Trump folks won't talk about that around liberals, and that's just it's a corrosive thing to the Republic, I think.
Yeah, I happened to marry a young lady years ago. We're still married. She used to march in no nuke parades. Okay. This is John Cass marrying my liberal Democratic wife. People used to do that. I mean, you could love a girl or woman irrespective of her politics. Now it's almost like when we were little kids, or maybe in the previous generation, an Episcopalian would not marry a Methodist, or a family of Catholics couldn't handle it if the Orthodox, a Greek or a Jew came into the neighborhood or into the family. And now it's almost that politics has become our religion, and it's even divided even more when journalism is in pursuit of clicks. So therefore, the over the top story or coverage of something appeals to the demographic that will click it. Right. The other day, I wrote a column about Mr. General Flynn and the story about whether he accepted money from Turkey and then tried to stop the United States from involving itself with Kurdish fighters in Syria. To me, that's a serious matter, and I think it smells, and that's serious, and I see there's something there. I haven't seen anything on the Russian deal, but there I do. And people were criticizing me for not being tougher on Flynn when I said it was basically treason. Because we're, treason's not strong enough, and I said Trump shouldn't tweet like that because he shows panic and fear, and that's not presidential. Those things aren't strong enough for some people. I mean, what do they want, Tom? And so we get into this this thing where writers and editors, I think, are being influenced by the clicks and the whatever that is, the new media, the way to measure things, and it becomes even more and more divided and tribal. We we complain about the tribal nature of it, and then we feed it, which means the center of the country is collapsing faster than we think.
And that's with that. And, I interviewed Condi Rice. She was in Chicago this week to talk about her book. And I asked her about this sort of populist surge that happened here in America and is happening, in other places. Sort of the crisis of confidence that we're having in ourselves, in our democracy, in our institutions. And she said that she's concerned about it and that we're dividing along class lines more so than we ever have. Right. And one of the biggest dividing lines in November was education, right? Folks who were educated, well-educated, voted for Hillary Clinton, and folks who had, less than a college degree voted overwhelmingly for Trump. And that was a significant shift from past historical precedent, right? If you go back and look at previous elections, and because you had a section of the country that felt like they had been left behind, that no one was talking to them, people didn't share their values, all of those things. And Trump was the only one who managed to speak to those people and make a connection with them, even among the 16 Republican candidates, by the way, in the primary, who was able to forge this bond with them because he was speaking their language and talking in a way that they felt like he recognized them. So I do think we've split up among, in a variety of ways, and class is certainly one of them. Education's another. And it's tough to see. My question to Condi Rice was, how do we turn this around? What do we need to do? I mean, she feels like we need some sort of national unifying effort around whether it's education or opportunity, some sort of sense of national purpose, right? We used to have Teach for America. We used to have the Peace Corps. We used to have something. that brought Americans together. You know, and these days it's even because we're segmented among communities, right? The red states are getting redder, the blue states are getting bluer. So it's not like you can just necessarily go down the street and you know, meet someone who has different political views than you and forge some sort of community that way. I mean, we really do need something that, that unifies the country somehow. And, you know, I don't know how we're going to get there, but without that, I think, you know, it's going to be really, really hard to reverse what's happened in this country over the last, you know, 10, 15 years.
Yeah. Sometimes I think we're, historians might look at this as a pre-revolutionary psychosis, and I'm not kidding. It's because the guys who were on in the red states, the Trump guys, they don't play. I mean, it's not about playing. They're trying to survive. Those coal miners.
Well, this is
they're trying to survive.
Yeah, and this is one more point I'll make real quickly, John. This is why I think this drive among Democrats to impeach the president. Is so not only cynical, but dangerous. You know, let these investigations play out, whatnot, but to try and make everything into a constitutional crisis, can you imagine how torn apart this country would be if the 60 million people who voted for Donald Trump, who the Democrats have, you know, they think the Democrats have been trying to invalidate their choice for the past 6 months, if somehow impeachment proceedings and this guy either has to resign or whatever, and they feel like he's been targeted unfairly, this country will, I think, come apart at the seams. That would be an awful result, unless there's evidence to show that it's justified. But if it is, you know, if it's a witch hunt and he gets drummed out of office because of a witch hunt, the folks in Trump country are going to be very, very unhappy about it.
Yeah, because they've already been written off as deplorables. They've already been written off as less than human by most of the coverage that I see, by most of the snarky, lefty, snarky newsroom snickering. And you know what, Tom? You know why I know that? Because I've been in the business 30 years and you've been in it a long time, too. And it's bad for the country. I do have to ask one thing that's good for the country, though. And that is the idea that Tom Bevin can actually drive a van while he's talking to Molly Hemingway from the Federalist or other people. How do you tell us about that just briefly, if you could? The idea of Tom Bevin driving, you drive around in a car with Tom Bevin and he talks to you and he doesn't crack up the car. How does that work?
So we've got this thing called changing lanes, which we get, you know, we rig up a car with cameras and microphones and we drive around and just talk to people. And the idea is to, I always pitch it to people, they say it's like Meet the Press on wheels, only more fun and more interesting. And it is, it's a fun thing because it really does offer a chance for a more intimate conversation. You're not around studios and with folks and cameras and lights and all that. You really have a nice conversation with people. And we try to keep it sort of informal. And we've been doing this for a couple of years. You've been in the car, John. I got to get you in the car again.
I've been in the car with you. And what struck me was that we were driving around the loop and you're talking. And I'm like thinking, how do you concentrate? I have to pull I got to pull at 72nd and Western at Fat Johnny's and sit down with that's where we should go. We'll go to Fat Johnny's next time I'm in your car. Two Fat Johnny's okay. And a Bevin. Okay.
It is a challenge to drive and try and, you know, conduct an interview and talk and stay focused. But to our credit, and I'm going to knock on wood when I say this, we have not gotten in an accident or injured anyone. Everyone who's gotten in the car has gotten out safe and sound. And so we have to keep our streak going.
Now that we're ruled by lawyers, you had to bring that up. And it's true. You drive extremely safely. You know, I've never seen, in my testimony, you have never taken any chances in the car. You're always slow and within the traffic rules. So anyway, Tom Bevin, when are you going to ask me on your radio show, man, so I could do it next time? Because you asked me before and I couldn't do it.
Anytime, John. I'm always happy to have you. You're my go-to guy. Anytime.
Tom Bevin, Real Clear Politics, the Harvard Media Study, and talk about the dissolution of the center and the fragmenting of the American politic. Thank you very much, Tom.
You bet.
See you. Thanks for listening to another edition of the Chicago Way with Jeff Carlin, Kristen McQuarrie of the Chicago Tribune editorial board, Tom Bevan, co-founder of Real Clear Politics, and John Cass, whose 31st wedding anniversary takes place in a few days. So I better get something besides fire tickets. Thanks for listening. We'll talk to you again next week, okay? See ya.